I am Rich M. Phillips from the SEC Historical Society, and I'm here to interview for the Society Milton Kroll. We're at the offices of Foley & Lardner, a law firm in Washington, D.C., with which Mr. Kroll serves as a counsel at 3050 K Street, Northwest Washington. And we're interviewing Mr. Kroll because he served at the commission for a period of 14 years, from 1940 to 1953, in the office of general counsel, starting as an attorney at $2,600 per year, and ending in 1953 as associate general counsel of the SEC. We've seen a lot of the SEC during the early days, and we're here today to see if we can tap Mr. Kroll's memory for posterity. Mr. Kroll, why did you go to work at the SEC in 1940?
Well, 1940 was in the depths of the Depression, and the possibility of getting a job at the SEC at $2,600 a year was very appealing.
And that was appealing even though you were a graduate of Harvard?
Oh, yes. It was difficult to get jobs anyplace. It's hard today to understand that, but when you compare it to the $140,000 of graduates of Harvard Law School get today, it was hard to understand. But
now, during your tenure at the SEC, who were the chairman and some members of the commission?
Well, when I went to work there, the chairman was Jerome Frank, a prominent member of the commission then, Republican member, was Judge Haley. He served several terms, I believe. Gansom Purcell succeeded Jerome Frank. He was a chairman for a good time. Ralph Demler was a chairman, Republican chairman. Harry McDonald, also a Republican chairman, although that, interestingly enough, was during the Truman administration. In those days, before 1950, the chairman of the commission was selected by the members of the commission, not by the president. Mm-hmm. And that apparently accounts for the fact that there was a Republican chairman during the Truman administration.
And that was changed in
1950
by Act of Congress.
Yes. Others, Don Cook was a prominent chairman. Dick McIntyre, as a commissioner, I worked with on the Canadian Extradition Treaty. He was an important member there. By and large, the commissioners were extremely capable, and I thought very talented.
Mm-hmm. What about your colleagues? Who were your colleagues? Can you give us some names, and what was it like to work with them?
Well, I certainly have a lot of memories of my colleagues. One, Lewis Laws, became my best friend. In fact, unfortunately, I was a eulogist at Harvard at his memorial service.
He was in general counsel's office.
He was in the general counsel's office. He incidentally started at $2,000 a year because he went there directly from Yale Law School. And of course, he.
Are you suggesting that Yale graduates did not command as high a price as the Harvard graduates?
No. It was just the ground rule for when you left. I came several years after I got out of law school because I was waiting for that job, and with bated breath. Milton Freeman was an important person in that office. He was the person you reported to. Over the years. There were many, many, many people. Manny Cohn, who later became a chairman. Irv Pollack, who also became a chairman, whom I hired, by the way, in general counsel's office. Stanley Sporkin. There were many, and we were all very close friends.
Who was the general counsel and your superiors?
Well, when I went there, the general counsel was Chester T. Lane. He was a Wall Street, what can I say, Wall Street type. He came from a Wall Street law firm, I believe. He was the general counsel, the assistant general counsel in charge of enforcement, which was also one of the functions of the general counsel's office, was Robert E. Klein. Thereafter, there were some changes made. Initially, the general counsel's office, about 100 attorneys, did all the legal work in the commission. There were a few lawyers in the regional offices, but there were no lawyers assigned to the various divisions as lawyers. Some of the people there who did administrative, performed administrative functions were lawyers, but they were not there as lawyers. In about late 1943, I know just before I went into Army service, they changed that. The general counsel's office became the solicitor's office.
Mm-hmm.
Each one of the divisions had a counsel to the divisions. I know Lou Lawis went to become counsel to the Division of Trading and Markets. I was about to go in the Army, so I was stayed at the solicitor's office. The solicitor then was Roger Foster, who had been in the 35 Act Division. He came over, and he was the solicitor. Thereafter, during the war, shifted back again, and the general counsel's office became the chief litigator, chief legal office of the commission. And Roger Foster was the general counsel. John F. Davis, who was the assistant general counsel with whom we all work.
And John F. Davis went on to be a chief assistant in the solicitor's office,
yes,
for many, many years.
Solicitor General's office, yes.
That's right.
Actually, he had come from the Solicitor General's office initially, I believe. He went over there to thereafter. Just as I was about to leave, William Timbers became chairman. Ralph Demler became chairman, and he appointed Bill Timbers. Bill Timbers went on to become a judge in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals.
Now, for purposes of context, I'd like to probe your memory as to what was happening in government, in the securities industry, and at the Commission generally. But let's divide it up, if you will, between the pre-Army service. I understand you were in the Army for 3 years. That was what?
1942? 43 to about 45.
Okay. Let's divide it into pre-Army service and post-Army service. Okay. Or pre-World War II and post-World War II. What do you recall about the what was happening in the economy, the country, the securities industry pre-World War II?
To use the term you use for baseball games, I think the financial firms were warming up. The Depression had set everyone back. They were warming up. They were curious. They were trying.
Mm-hmm.
By and large, they were quite cooperative, I thought. This is the pre-World War II period. So far as the commission was concerned, these were years in which we were trying out things, trying to develop the concepts that later prevailed. As an example of what was going on at the commission, I must say a word about someone who wasn't in the general counsel's office, but who performed a very important function. Baldwin Bain had come over to the commission from the Federal Trade Commission, which, as you know, administered the Securities Act for a year before the commission was created by Congress. He had some very important people with him, a man named Andrew Jackson, not a very good name to have, and Ted McCormick,
uh-huh,
who later wrote a book and became a commissioner. In any event, the reason I want to make these remarks about Baldwin Bain is because he developed the registration process as we know it today. And the act was passed, all it said was that you file a registration statement and 20 days later you become effective unless the commission issues a stop order. Well, that's pretty hard business. Bain created the idea of deficiency letters. You filed your registration statement, his people in the registration division would examine, and they'd send you a deficiency letter. You complied with that, then they try to make you effective. Now, actually, at that point, people who cooperated complained that they had to wait another 20 days.
Because each time they complied with the deficiency letter, they filed a new amendment.
An amendment in 20 days.
That started a new 20-day period.
So Congress took care of that. The commission got them to pass a law providing for acceleration. And I have a piece from the New York Times which talks about that, which you're welcome to have. It's on the back of the thing, noting that the 40 Act was passed.
Let's call this Exhibit A to the office. Okay?
What went on in the early days were matters of training and understanding. Everybody was trying to get that way. Well,
you were saying trying to develop concepts, and there was
concepts.
Of efficiency letter,
right,
and acceleration.
Yes,
and we would
go out to people from the general counsel's office would go out to the regional offices and conduct forums, and have programs, and explain things to lawyers, accountants, and so forth. We were growing up. When I got back from the Army, things were quite different.
How were they different?
People were much more sophisticated. A lot of people whose objectives were not noble would try to take advantage of the fact that there were a lot of highly reputable investment banking firms, and enforcement became an important thing. One thing I worked on was the Canadian Extradition Treaty. I worked on that with Commissioner McIntyre, promoters of mining ventures make fraudulent offerings here, and we couldn't get them down here to prosecute them. So we had to go up, and it was very difficult to do this sort of State Department work, but we did it and got that done. That was one of the things. It was a much more sophisticated thing later on.
With a more of an emphasis on enforcement rather than education and.
Yes.
Okay.
Enforcement and there was litigation. And there were some things. Now, there's one thing. I'd like to mention there was a group. I guess the most active litigation experience at the commission was in connection with the Kaiser Fraser Otis Company matter. Kaiser Fraser developed a new automobile. Cyrus Eaton, Cleveland, had a brokerage firm, Otis and Company, and they entered into an underwriting contract. Well, they filed a registration statement. Things weren't going so good at that particular time for this issue. It was a new automobile.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a Buick or a Cadillac or
so
forth. A lot of competition. And they had a lot of disputes. One day, there was a lawsuit filed by a lawyer in Philadelphia named Masterson. And, of course, that would provide an out under the underwriting contract. This got the commission somewhat exercised because people wrote in and said, what is this? And they started a public investigation.
Uh-huh.
no one knew whether the commission had the power to have a public investigation. I was in that because I was named the hearing officer. I was in charge of the hearing. And the Louis Laws was the counsel, along with Charles Odenweller, a man named Russ Kelly, who was a chief litigator of the commission. And they had this long hearing. In the meantime, the Kaiser Fraser people and Otis and company people were in court all the time. I don't know whether anybody ever won, but the one thing that came out of it was that in one court opinion, I forget which one at this point, it was made clear that the SEC did have the power to have public investigations.
And that Kaiser Fraser Otis litigation, that occurred before or after he came back to the service?
When?
After. What were the significant issues confronting the commission, say, after he came back to the service? Mostly enforcement issues.
Well, enforcement, there was the Canadian Extradition Treaty.
Right.
The enforcement issues were, yes, I think they loomed very large. So far as litigation is concerned, there were no great litigation matters except to the extent that the Kaiser Fraser Otis people kept the General Counsel's office in court quite a bit. But it was still in the developmental stage, Dick. The commission wasn't the law firm. The general counsel's office wasn't the law firm that it later became.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm comparing an aggregation of people who are trying to find their way to establish ground rules with a large Wall Street law firm. Which later became very much like a large Wall Street law firm. Mm. But in the days I was there, it hadn't gotten to that point.
What do you think was the most, let's take the pre-World War II period, what do you think the most significant achievement failure of the commission during that
period? At the commission? Well, I think it was the development of the two things. First, the development of the registration process so that it made sense and it is still in effect today. Mm-hmm. That was very important.
The deficiency letter followed
and,
by...
That's right, and acceleration.
Acceleration.
Yes. And also the educational side. The fact that we would go out into the regions and conduct seminars and so forth. Also, it's interesting that right before the war, the SEC did quite a job in providing the War Department with bombing targets.
Oh, tell us about that.
Well, I have a letter here. Where is the letter? So here's a letter from the chief of Far Eastern Section Operational Intelligence Division, John Haas, Major Air Corps, Chief Far Eastern Section Operational Intelligence Division, Assistant Chief of Air Staff. This is in 1943. Happens to refer to me, but it indicates what we were doing. Mr. Milton P. Kroll of the SEC has been of inestimable aid to this office in obtaining information for the planning of bombing missions. His contributions on this score has involved an extensive and intensive search among files, publications, and people in a position to provide data of this kind. This is the sort of thing we did. See, this was still we're still in a developmental stage, Dick.
Now, what do you think made the Army think that an SEC lawyer had the ability to help them identify?
Well, obviously, people filed registration statements with information about their companies.
So it was, the Army used the SEC to gain access to that.
Oh, so there were proxy statements and annual reports.
Reservoir of information.
The SEC
files.
Yes, indeed.
And that was in the pre-computer age,
right? Right, yes, indeed.
Okay. After, before we do that, do you recall any matter, any issue, which you regard as a commission failure during the pre-war two period?
Well, when you search your memory, you don't think about failures. I haven't thought much about failures. I can tell you about another plus,
okay,
an achievement, which drew congratulations from Franklin D. Roosevelt. There was a company known as Empire Ordnance Corporation. This was right before the war. It had been promoting the company, selling stock, and on the basis of being a company that was providing war material, people were attracted to this sort of company. The SEC started an investigation of this because it had received word that things weren't all that Empire Ordnance, which was the company, were making people think it was. Well, the commission conducted an inquiry. It was a rather long inquiry. I know I worked on it. And it finally filed a report to the president telling him about what this company was like. Well, when I was in the Army, 1943, a letter addressed to Private Milton Crowell of Fort Custer, Michigan, from Ganson Purcell, chairman. It says that the report to the president on Empire Ordnance Corporation has been delivered to the White House, and the president has written me a letter expressing his appreciation of the job done. This took up a great deal of time and a large number of people. But this was part of the... We were in a war. This was a war effort.
And this was not securities fraud. It was basically a more defense fraud, was it?
No, it was securities fraud because they were trying to sell securities. But it was also defense fraud.
Okay.
Because they were dealing with... It had two sides to it.
Yes,
two sides to it.
And the President of the United States, the White House, was interested.
Yes, indeed. And they wrote letters to the commission about it. And I've got copies of it in the news.
We'll call that exhibit.
Loan to you.
We'll call that exhibit two.
Loan to you.
Okay, let's move now, fast forward, to the post-World War II part of your tenure. Starting in 1946, late 45. What were the issues confronting the commission during the period 45-46 to 1953? What was happening?
Well, things were very busy, of course, with the securities offerings. I mentioned one thing, it was an enforcement thing. It was the promotion of Canadian mining ventures by fraudulent promoters. Necessary to work out an extradition treaty so we could get them down here. One of the things I worked on. It's hard to recollect the flow of litigation, but there was a lot more litigation. But it's hard to remember the specific cases.
But I gather from what you're saying is that the focus was on offerings of securities and fraud enforcement.
Right.
Now, what about the 35 Act, the Public Utility Holding Company Act of 1935?
That was almost a world of its own.
Was it an important world?
Very important. Very important because it was an antitrust type of arrangement to prevent these companies from... And it sort of worked its way out. I think they resolved the questions. They had some very, very competent people there. Milton Cohn, others were over there, Roger Foster, and they ultimately worked out the problems there. The 40 Act had just started. there wasn't too much going on there, but they were starting to see the development of the mutual fund industry. And that created a number of problems. There was some work under the Chapter 10 of the Bankruptcy Act at that time. There were several cases. But they were not extensive.
Now, you've mentioned a number of significant matters in which you worked on. Are there any others that you can recall?
Well, look here. Let's see what I wrote down here. When I was at the commission, yeah. No, I suppose that
those are the main ones
that I remember at this point.
Right. Now, tell us about your memories of the SEC, okay? The people, what was it like to work there? Have any vivid memories that you'd like to share with us?
Yes, I have some very important memories. An esprit de corps and a bond of friendship among the people who worked there, which I think is not paralleled in too many places. I know in my own case, I made friends there. I mentioned Lou Loss being one of my best friends. We lectured all over the world together. I'm sure he was the chief attraction, but I went with him. To Brazil, twice to Japan, to Hong Kong, and we even went to China to lecture there on corporations. Well, we were good friends, and we worked together on things. The esprit de corps was contributed to greatly by the commissioners. The one thing I must tell you about, because probably the least intellectually directed chairman that I remember, I think played a very big part in building the esprit de corps of the commission. He was a chairman, Harry McDonald. I may have mentioned to you that he was appointed during the Truman administration. But he built an esprit de corps. He would visit offices, come in and see how you were doing, pat you on the back. If you did anything commendable, he'd be there to say, great. He would attend all social functions. He was an extreme example, but also the other commissioners were interested in staff. And it's a very vivid memory I have, very vivid memory. Have I mentioned to you the diplomas of the that were awarded to staff members who left. If I did, I'll repeat it.
No, you haven't. No.
There was a custom that grew up that I think reflects the staff commission relationship. This is for the people who were in the higher staff levels. But when you left the commission, you'd receive a diploma. I have it home in a prominent place. A diploma reflecting your graduation from the Institute of High and Low Finance, the SEC. Well, mine was signed by Chairman Don Cook and Commissioners Paul Rowan, Clarence Adams, Dick McIntyre, and Howard Mosbach. Well, I'm sure others value theirs very greatly. Incidentally, in Lou Loss's book, Anecdotes of the Securities Lawyer, where he talks about many of the things that I'm talking about today, he says that one of the things he was most pleased to take away from the SEC with him was his diploma, his graduation from the Institute of High and Low Finance.
Now, he left the SEC in 1953. Why?
Well, support my family, had a child. And I thought I'd been there long enough, and I'd better go out and see if I could develop something of an estate for my family and support them.
And what did you do it?
Well, a law firm in town, Brown, London, Fitzgerald, had been talking to me. They wanted me to come out because they had some SEC matters that they wanted someone to take care of. And I went with them, and I was with them for about six years or so. Thereafter, I joined in starting a law firm with two people whom I had met at the SEC. Walter Friedman, who when I came to the SEC was a legal assistant for Judge Haley. And I think he also worked with David Schenker on some 40 Act matters. He wasn't at the commission too long, but we became friends there. Arnold Levy was in the 35 Act group. And one of his associates was a fellow named Gerald Simons. And we formed the law firm Friedman, Levy, Kroll, and Simons, which existed. Well, we did a great deal of SEC work, and in fact, hired a lot of people from the SEC. Peter Panerites, Arthur Bill, Gary Cohn, Tom Lauerman, they came over to the firm. Joan Boros came for a while. Did a great deal of work in various fields. I think I was the first to work on the syndication of real estate properties. I've been thinking since what happened the other day whether we syndicated any properties near the World Trade Center. I know we did the Empire State Building, and I have a picture up there.
You may have been the first SEC alumni to develop a securities practice in Washington.
Conceivably. I also became active in the field of variable insurance products at that time, and as I say, they still work on that, my friends here, and still do. I became active also in some other things I should mention to you. I was a consultant to the American Law Institute on several things they did that had an SEC slant. The ALI Federal Securities Code Project, published it in 1980, but that was an attempt to codify the securities laws. People very active in it were Milton Cohn, Lou Laws, Dave Ruder, and Victor Brudney. There were some others, and lawyers who had practiced in the SEC field from Wall Street firms. As a result of that, we ran a program with the New York Stock Exchange for some of their their members on the securities code, and I got to know the people at the exchange, and I was an inaugural member of their legal advisory committee. I served as its chairman twice, and I'm still an ex officio member. That's not quite emeritus, but I'm on their nominating committee and so forth. I also was a consultant to the ALI Corporate Governance Project. That was in the 90s. It came out in 1992. All that about winds that up. I should mention this. Incidentally, in the Army service, since I'm listing all these things, I'm kind of proud of the fact that I was in charge of intelligence and security at the Potsdam Conference at the end of World War II. I'm probably the only person you know who was ever invited to a cocktail party by Joseph Stalin. And I received a Bronze Star Medal in that connection. Incidentally, there's another thing. I was given an award just last year. You were probably at the meeting. I don't know, Dick. By the ALI-ABA conference on life insurance projects. Reflecting the work I did in the early days on that, and they awarded me a lovely crystal object. Which has these words at the end. In appreciation for extraordinary contributions to taking variable insurance from paradox to paradigm. I thought that was rather nice. Dick, I suppose that's about all I have to say.
Let me ask a couple more follow-up questions.
Sure.
How would you compare the commission during your tenure there and today, or in recent years when you've had contact with the commission? What's changed? What's changed for good? What's changed for bad?
Well, there's a growth pattern. There's a growth pattern here you have to consider. We were largely, in the earlier days, certainly in a development stage. Later on, when I got out of the Army, we came back to Washington, it started to have more of the feel of a large law firm, and I think that's the way I would characterize the way I have viewed the commission since then. Still extremely competent people, and I still have the highest regard for the people there. I don't always agree with the things they come out with, obviously. Some of the points are arguable, but highly competent, and I still have the highest regard for them.
Has the esprit de corps changed?
I can't say that because I'm not there. I'm not there.
Any other thoughts or memories that you'd like to share with us?
Well, I've mentioned the fact that there was a long line of highly competent general counsel.
Right.
There was a long line of highly competent commissioners. I didn't know Joseph Kennedy when it started, so I can't say much about him. But Jerome Frank, to me, is a young fellow out of law school a few years. I was dazzled by him. I think it's also important to remember how many commission staff members became commissioners. Ted McCormick, Manny Cohn, others.
Irv Pollack.
I think that was important, but I look at the present commission with a great deal of respect, but I don't know the ins and outs as much as I did in the earlier days, so I can't really draw a true comparison.
Any other thoughts or memories?
I think that about exhausts my exhausts my memories.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kroll. Thank you.
You're welcome. Now,
today is September 13. The interview started a little after 11 a.m. and now ends at 12 noon. September 13, 2001.